Okay, greetings. Welcome to our makeup class. Appreciate those of you that are able to be here. It's always more fun to talk to a live group than, you know, pretend. I've always marveled at news people and all that can talk to a camera as though it's a person, but it's nice to have real people. Generally, this is intended to be a lecture, partly and mainly because the material is such that it's a series of distinctions and small cases that make a pattern. It's not really something for which we have this grand theoretical design or discussion. So it's generally useful to lecture on it. Even when I'm not doing a makeup class, I usually lecture on it. But feel free, if something's not clear or if you have a short question, to go ahead and interject since you're here. That will probably help not only you, but the people that are listening on podcast or are watching the video. So anyway, here's the attendance sheet if you'd like to record your attendance today. And again, if you're listening on podcast or on video, I will be passing around a roll sheet the last day of class, and you're not only for that class but also for this session. And you can certify, consistent with the student honor code, that you have done that. I'm definitely going to cover the material today that I assigned. The question, if we have extra time, I've brought along couple of MBE questions that are answerable based on this material, and we'll use those. Again, this is an area that actually causes a fair amount of confusion at the contextual level, at the level of what are we doing here. It's largely, these three fundamental, implied fundamental rights are largely under equal protection by historical accident, by the fact that the way the case law was developed when these doctrines were established, equal protection seemed to be a more friendly locale or venue for them than due process. But as you know, what's initially weird about these cases is that we are implying rights, calling them fundamental in some cases, applying strict scrutiny, but under the domain of equal protection rather than due process. And that sort of doesn't fit the usual pattern, which is why they're in a separate section on the syllabus. So again, just by way of brief introduction, as we know, equal protection, as we saw, is largely about occurring, an equal protection claim occurs when government draws lines between groups of people, you know, burdens one group, benefits another, and the argument is, hey, wait a minute, we're equal. And we've seen that for all line drawing, rational basis is the standard. But that if we want strict scrutiny, we have to say that the line's being drawn based on race or national origin. Even gender discrimination or marital status, whether your parents were married, illegitimacy discrimination, doesn't fly under strict scrutiny, it flies under intermediate scrutiny. So what we've seen really, and what we spent most of our time studying under equal protection, is a system where the issues created when there's a classification that disadvantages some, advantages others, and it's when we can find a basis for suspect scrutiny, suspect classification or heightened scrutiny that we go there. And again, in the cases we'll see in certain areas with respect to voting, and certain areas with respect to access to the courts and discrimination based on out-of-state residency, we'll see that the court is applying strict scrutiny. It's throwing around the words of compelling interest, narrowly drawn, or at least heightened scrutiny, even though there is no race discrimination or gender discrimination or anything that we've held dear. Seems like these cases would make more sense on the due process side. After all, substantive due process is the basis that we use to say that certain interests in liberty are fundamental, and when they're fundamental, they trigger strict scrutiny or undue burden for abortion. And when they're not fundamental, they, again, fly by a rational basis. So it would seem like, if we're talking about the right to vote, or the right to have access to courts, or the right to travel interstate and relocate interstate without discrimination, it would seem like that would be more comfortably situated under due process. And I think, actually, that is really more logical in terms of where to put these cases. The problem is, as I said, for largely historical reasons, and I'm sure this is not the only time in your legal studies where a legal doctrine that seems to be misplaced or seems to be where it is more as an accident of precedential developments and where lines of cases are and all that than sheer logic. And this is one of those cases. Okay, so whether it's equal protection or due process, it is the so-called fundamental rights strand of equal protection. And there's a number of, you may have noticed if you've looked at the reading through the assignment, and that was, of course, not necessary at this point. You'll probably want to do it after the lecture. This lecture was designed to be relatively accessible even without that. But if you've looked at the materials and you've read through the assignment, you see that, it is largely a series of individual cases that make these rather arcane distinctions. And so really it's an area of law where con law II students and people that plan to take the multi-state bar need to understand to a certain extent the theoretical construct or the theoretical basis, but really the action is in understanding the distinctions that are drawn, learning where the line is. And it's a series of little points. You know, on my con law II exam, it's likely to be on the multiple choice. It's unlikely to be in a major essay question. I threw it in as a small issue in a major essay a year ago. Special purpose water district or special purpose election district versus a general purpose one. But again, not a lot of in-depth discussion and analogizing and arguments back and forth, partly because the area doesn't lend itself to that. It's a bunch of little minor distinctions. But also because, of course, you don't have extensive excerpts from the cases. So you don't have really much of an ability to make arguments back and forth. So really that's what it's about. And hopefully if we have a little extra time at the end of the discussion, I'll show you how, in fact, actual multi-state bar questions can be answered using these materials. Okay, so on page 766... we have the denial of the right to vote being asserted as a fundamental right under equal protection. And the court says, even though the Constitution does not carve out an express right to vote, the court is going to imply it and imply that it's fundamental. And you may be thinking, wait a minute, the Constitution talks about a right to vote. It does, but in limited context. It gives people a right to vote in presidential elections, or it gives Congress power to regulate the time, place, and manner of state legislative elections. The 14th and 15th Amendments protect the right to vote as against race discrimination. And equal protection has been deemed to affect the right to vote, not to have your vote, votes diluted as an urban voter because you've got a lot more urban voters in your legislative voting district than rural voters. That's, of course, Baker versus Carr, the whole redistricting series of cases, and the one person, one vote standard in Reynolds versus Sims. So there is, there is actual discrimination in voting on the basis of race or on the basis of numbers. Hey, not fair that five times as many urban voters have to vote for one representative. Our votes are diluted. There's that kind of basis. But there is no general recognition of a right to vote that would cover these kinds of discrimination that are taking place in these cases. And so ordinarily, the lines that are being drawn under equal protection would be subject to rational basis review. That's what we get if we don't show some special classification based on race or gender or something like that. Here, we don't have that. At most, we have wealth classifications. And as you know, wealth classifications have never been used, have never generated anything more than rational basis review. So in some of these cases, the court is affording strict scrutiny or strong protection to the implied fundamental right to vote. And the point is, that's why they have to imply it as a right under equal protection, because it doesn't comfortably locate itself in any express right that the court recognized even under equal protection. Okay, so what do we have in Harper versus Virginia State Board of Elections? We have a poll tax, $1.50 poll tax, which is pretty hefty back in 1966, to vote. Although poll taxes had been previously used on a racially discriminatory basis, just like voter tests had been used on a racially discriminatory basis. This one is not that. This one applies regardless of race. So if it discriminates against any group, it discriminates against poor people, people for whom $1.50 to vote in 1966 is a big deal. And as Justice Black points out on page 768, it is rational. This law would pass rational basis review. As he says, when he dissents, he says, look, there's several reasons for why a state could reasonably or rationally want to charge a poll tax. One, it raises revenue. Good way to raise revenue. And we, certainly in California, appreciate the value of a state raising revenue. Or it could be rational to think that people who are willing to pay a reasonably hefty fee to vote must be really interested. They have a stake. If you have to pay to vote, you have to be very interested in voting, and you now have a stake because you paid your money for it. And as he points out, history's on the side of the rationality of the poll tax. Poll taxes have been traditionally used. So it's pretty clear, and he's right, that if all we were subjecting this to were a rational basis review, which of course is again what we get under equal protection if we don't show some special suspect classification basis, and what we even get for wealth classifications, they just have to be rational. The court says, no, rational basis doesn't work here. Because one has a fundamental right. Once you're granted the right to vote, you have a fundamental right to vote that can't be interfered with unless the statute is narrowly drawn to accomplish a compelling interest. As the court says in the very last paragraph on 767, we have long been mindful that where fundamental rights and liberties are asserted under the Equal Protection Clause, classifications which might invade or restrain them must be closely scrutinized and carefully confined. The principles apply here, top of 768. For to repeat, wealth or fee paying has, in our view, no relation to voting qualifications. No relation? Overstatement, but certainly no narrowly drawn relation to a compelling interest. The right to vote is too precious, too fundamental to be burdened or conditioned. So Harper is the case that establishes that there is a fundamental right to vote that cannot be discriminated against or cannot be taken away by discriminatory legislation without passing, a closely scrutinized standard of review that in later cases at times becomes clear that it's strict scrutiny, or certainly higher scrutiny. Of course, since this is a new edition, your authors have stuck in a note 3 on page 769 that is nothing less than Bush versus Gore, a case that I spend some time talking about in Con Law 1 under the political question doctrine. Here, though, Bush is being used, because as you know, Bush established that the failure to do a recount in 2000 in Florida, which was going to determine who won the election under the Electoral College, give them the majority of Electoral College votes, doing a recount on a differential basis where different standards were used from one county to the next and even within a county for the recount, violated equal protection, was arbitrary. And there's a whole argument about it. Is it really arbitrary and how does the law extend and all that? But what's being looked at in here is the court, again, in Bush versus Gore in 2000, continues to call the right to vote fundamental. As they say in the first paragraph of this textual quote on 769, when the state legislature vests the right to vote for president in its people, the right to vote as the legislature has prescribed is fundamental. And one source of its fundamental nature lies in the equal weight accorded to each vote and the equal dignity owned to each voter. The right to vote is protected in more than the initial allocation of the franchise, who has the right to vote, but as well as the manner of the exercise, and can't be undercut by arbitrary and disparate treatment. And of course, the authors go on to ask you, does this really mean what it means, and how broad is this fundamental right to vote, especially if, as Bush extended it, isn't just the right to go to the polls, but the right to actually have your vote counted equally. That if that's a fundamental right and we apply strict scrutiny to that, then we got some interesting questions that apply. The state by the county by county or within county arbitrary distinctions for vote count standards in Bush versus Gore and the Florida recount are an easy case. Because actually 7 out of the 9 justices say, listen, this is a statewide recount. It's overseen by one single judicial official. There's no justification for these variations. They're arbitrary. They're irrational. But as Bush went to great effort to try the case, when I say Bush, I mean the Bush versus Gore, not Bush, George Bush. As Bush versus Gore went to great pains to point out, it wasn't establishing an right to equal vote counting under strict scrutiny that would apply in lots of cases. Like, wait a minute, it's unfair. My county uses a different vote count method. We use touch screens, which have a higher error rate, or we don't use touch screens, which have a lower, they have a lower error rate. We use punch ballots. Or, wait a minute, how come we don't have enough poll watchers so that the lines in my poor district are a lot longer? That's not fair. That's inequality in manner. Lots of questions arise from Bush versus Gore, but Bush made a special effort to try to say this. It was a decision only for that particular case. Anyway, that's not a lot to say about that. I mean, well, there's a lot to say about it, but not a lot I'm going to say about it. But Bush is a modern case that talks about the right to vote as fundamental and extends it to the right, certain aspects of the right to be treated equally in the manner in which your vote is counted, not just your access to the polls. And then we get the Kramer versus Union Free District case on page 770. And I'm trying not to show the book too much because I'm trying to make this user-friendly for podcast people as well. But, the first paragraph of the Kramer case on 770 says, what we have is a New York education law that says in certain New York school districts, residents can vote in the school district election only if they either owned or leased taxable real property or are parents or custodians of children who are enrolled in the public schools. So you got to either own property in the district or have kids. And the appellant is a bachelor who neither owns nor leases taxable real property or admits to having kids in the district. And so New York's law is questioned, and New York justifies it again under rational basis. They say, look, what we're trying to do is make sure that the people that vote in school district elections are people that have an interest. You either have an interest in who's on the school board. If you are parents of kids who are going to schools affected by that school board, or if you own or lease taxable real property because property taxes are supporting the school, you're paying for the schools. Some of you know this. You can be paying property taxes toward the schools even if you don't have kids there, or even have kids. And so either way, you get the right. But the appellant is apparently an absentee resident. He doesn't own or lease properties. Probably living with his parents or living with a relative or something. And he doesn't have kids, and he wants to vote. And so it would be rational. There's a conceivable legitimate interest here, which is to make sure that the people that vote in the election are especially interested. And this law serves that purpose. It's highly rational, in fact. But the court says not good enough. When we're talking about a limit on the franchise, as they say here in the third paragraph, if a challenged state statute grants the right to vote to some bona fide residents of relevant age and citizenship and denies it to others, the court must determine whether the exclusion is necessary to promote a compelling government interest. So they're using the compelling interest test and finding that this case flunks it. So in a general purpose election, like a school district or like back in the Harper case, the Virginia's general elections, it's very clear that restrictions on the franchise, restrictions on the right to vote, trigger a fundamental implied right to vote and need to be strictly scrutinized. and have to be narrowly drawn to accomplish a compelling interest, usually failed in this area just like every place else. And then we get on page 771 to some note cases where a more arcane and hair-splitting line is drawn. In all the note cases, starting at note 1 on page 771, we have cases where the elections are not sort of as general purpose. You know, even a school district election is kind of a typical election where people go and they select candidates, et cetera, et cetera. These are special elections. And the court draws a distinction between general purpose elections and special purpose elections. General purpose elections, the same strict scrutiny standard is applied, and it's part of the fundamental right to vote. However, if the entity of government and the action they're engaged in is not sufficiently generic, if there's a special purpose, and that special purpose relates to land owning or property owning or something, the court will allow those kinds of restrictions based on rational basis review. So what we have is a line that's being drawn. This is helpful, great. If not, I'm just going to go over these. Exclusions. I did this for my own purposes, not to display, so if it looks a little more arcane than even my usual handouts, my usual AVs, that's why. So the first case we come to on note 1 on page 771 is Cipriano versus City of Houma. And this is on the same day as Kramer, the case that, you know, just as we've seen, just established a right to participate equally in a school board election and not have you be discriminated against because you don't own property or kids don't go there to the school. But here we have a municipal utility bond election. And you could say, wait a minute, a municipal utility bond election is, it floats bonds based on the general full faith and credit of the municipality, you know, to build the utility, and that's therefore going to be paid by taxpayers. So who has a real interest in this election is taxpayers. Therefore, limiting it to property-owning taxpayers seems to make a lot of sense. But the court said, sorry, emphasizing that taxpayers didn't, or property tax owners didn't have any special burden, said that... The court emphasized that the revenue bonds were to be paid entirely from the operation of the utilities. So real property owners didn't have any special burden. Everybody was going to be paid based on, you know, there'd be a surcharge for every kilowatt hour of electricity from the utility. So that's easy to see. Everybody has it. Everybody who really is interested in this are the people that are going to pay for utilities. They're going to pay these bonds back. And that's everybody, not just property owners. That makes sense, Cipriano. Little harder to argue in the next case, which is Phoenix versus Kaladziewski. Hence, I will call it the Phoenix case. Second paragraph on note one. In the Phoenix case, it was only property-owning taxpayers voting, again, with general obligation bonds. But here the bonds were going to be paid primarily by property tax owners. So you could say, well, look, the bonds are going to be paid by property tax owners mainly. So that's, you know, it's valid. It's rational to limit it to only property-owning taxpayers. Court said, sorry, even if you're not a property owner, you still have a substantial interest in the services and facilities that will be financed by the bonds. And these are general obligation bonds. General obligation bonds are bonds that raise money to support a whole range of city services. So what do we see? We see that municipal utility, where the bonds are going to go toward a purpose that's going to be paid by everybody, fundamental right to vote still applies here, law invalidated under strict scrutiny. You can see why it's not narrowly drawn. Even if there's a compelling interest in trying to make sure the people who vote are the people that are really interested in this, to only limit it to property owners doesn't accomplish that. Might be some property owners that aren't as interested in non-property owners, and there certainly are non-property owners who are really interested. because they're going to end up footing the bill every time they pay their utility bill. And then when we have bonds that are, even if when the bonds are paid by property owners, if they're going to go for general city services, it's really like a general election. There's a general interest in this. Okay? And in that case, fundamental right law will be invalidated. By contrast, in note 2, we have the Sawyer case and the Ball versus James case. I've put them on the other side of the aisle here on this my little chart. These are not fundamental rights, and a state can make these distinctions if it has a rational basis for doing so, and therefore it does. So what's different about these two? These are limited purpose government units. These are government units that aren't there to provide general municipal services. They aren't there to provide electricity to everybody, and everybody pays. They are making property owners pay specially for a limited purpose service that's provided to the property owners. The easier one to understand is the Sawyer case. Sawyer Land Company said, the court upheld a California statute that permitted only landowners to vote in water storage district elections. I can hear you all's eyes rolling into your head like, you're kidding. The courts get into these kind of arcane distinctions. Yes, they do. Constitutionality turns on it. Success on the multi-state turns on it. But, you know, I dare say this is not the only class where we engage in picayune arcane distinctions. Shifting and springing interests in property come to mind, for example. And the law turns on that. Okay? So, Sawyer Land Company, on the top of page 772, note 2, says that it's okay for a California statute to permit only landowners to vote in water storage district elections. And it's even valid to give more voters to the bigger landowners. You get votes in proportion to the amount of property you own. And the court goes on to say that the main purpose of the district was to provide water for farming. The costs are mainly going to be assessed against landowners in proportion to the land they own or their use. So it kind of makes sense that the more land you own, and therefore the more you're going to pay for this water storage unit, the more you get to a say in who's going to run it. And so since this isn't a normal government authority, strict scrutiny is not appropriate. There's a relationship here. Good enough. Ball versus James extends Sawyer. Ball versus James, the paragraph under note 2, the second paragraph in note 2, definitely extends Sawyer. Because it's pointed out by your authors here, unlike the Water District in Sawyer, which was a sparsely populated agricultural area only really benefiting these landowners, here we have a water reclamation district that is financed by selling electricity to several hundred thousand residents. So you could say, wait a minute, I seem to remember under the past municipal election, the municipal electric district, the municipal utility bond election in Cipriano, okay, if it's going to provide electric service to a lot of people, there is a fundamental right to vote. No, not really, the court says. Nevertheless, the court found Sawyer rather than Kramer controlling. The court explained that the district, quote, cannot enact any laws governing the conduct of citizens, nor does it administer such normal functions of government as the maintenance of streets, the operation of schools or sanitation, health or welfare services. Yet, the sheer size of operations are true, but nevertheless, this is a special purpose district. This is essentially a relationship between consumers and a business enterprise, not voters and their general government. So, even if the specific distinctions drawn here are objectionable, and there are dissenters objecting from time to time in here, I think it's clear what the court is trying to do. They're trying to distinguish between when an election is for a general governmental purpose. That is when the whole city's floating bonds for a utility. Or the city is undertaking general obligation bonds to run a bunch of services. Are we acting like a general municipality, or is this a special purpose or limited purpose governmental unit that doesn't resemble the general purpose city unit? And if so, there is no fundamental right to vote in those elections, and therefore the government can limit vote participation to property owners and can even provide that the more property you own, the more you vote. And that's as long as that's rational, which it is usually going to be found to be in these cases. Let me make the last point about voting rights, and then I'll be happy to take any questions. Other than, are you kidding about this stuff? No, I'm not kidding. It's right here, right? The last issue I want to talk about is durational residency and enrollment requirements. That is, you know, people that move to a new area or want to change parties or something, to what extent can states restrict their voting in a primary or general election because they haven't met a timeline? And here, the court is definitely committed to, there actually is the closest we get in constitutional law to numerical distinctions, at least when you look at the results of the cases. And there's pairs of cases here. In the durational residency requirement, the note 3 on page 772, Dunn versus Blumstein is a leading case, 1972, that affirmed states' power to limit the franchise, limit voting to bona fide residents, but it invalidated a Tennessee statute that said you had to be in the state for 1 year and 3 months in the county. So Dunn invalidated a one-year state residency requirement. The way this worked is if you newly moved to the state of Tennessee, yeah, you couldn't vote in the election until you'd been a state resident for a year. Okay? And the court, and then you had to be in the county for three months. And the court said, yeah, you know, Tennessee does have some interest to make sure that, you know, people are protecting against fraud and to assure a knowledgeable voter. The fraud protection, of course, is if you could come and claim to, oh, yeah, I just got in the county yesterday. I want to vote. Be like, oh, really? Did you? Or were you paid money to come in and pretend you're a member of this county or a person of the state? Did you come over the border? It would be nice to tell you that American electoral law is the history of American elections is not stained by such voter fraud and voter manipulation, but that would be a lie. So that's a valid concern, and you know the idea that people that just breezed in, you know, may not be knowledgeable enough to vote in elections. But the court says, look, 30 days would be enough time to accomplish those goals, especially to prevent fraud. Yeah, you need a few days. You need giving voter people a month, saying, look, if you didn't register at least a month before the election, we're worried enough about fraud, and our records may not have kept caught up and all that sort of stuff. So that's allowable. But a year too long. And again, this is under, because it's inappropriate, it's a non-narrowly drawn interference with the fundamental right to vote. On the other hand, in the Marston case, Marston versus Lewis, the court upheld a 50-day durational residency requirement. That should say 50 days. I don't know why it says 55, but it's wrong on this one too. So, 50 days, okay. 30 days, okay. 50 days, okay. A year too long. Oh, okay. Well, where's the actual limit? Somewhere in the middle of those. That's where the line is. And then the same kind of phenomenon is going on with enrollment restrictions for voting in primaries. That is the note 6 on page 773. And as you know, there's a difference between voting in the general election and then voting in the party primary. States have all different kind of party rules, and in recent years, the Supreme Court has, under the First Amendment, jurisprudence said that parties have a substantial right to decide who votes in their primaries, how they conduct them. For example, we tried to pass a ballot initiative here in California a few years ago to require the parties to have an open primary law. The idea is that a voter could vote, could change primaries, and anybody who wanted to could vote in either the Republican or the Democratic, or, by the way, the Peace and Freedom and Natural Law Party and those other parties. And that was struck down by the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia writing it, saying, wait a minute, the political parties have a First Amendment right of association and free speech to decide who they're going to let be members in the party and who they're going to let vote in their elections. And the state can't make the Republican Party have to suddenly have a bunch of Democrats come in and skew the results, or vice versa. In any event, so that's what's going on in here, is in Rosario versus Rockefeller, we have a New York law that says if you're going to vote, to be eligible to vote in the next party primary, you have to register in the general election at least, you have to register your party affiliation at least 30 days before the general election. So the way this works is there's a general election for, you know, president and senator and all that. And then as much as 11 months later, there will be a primary election for the next, election for the next race. And if you don't say 30 days before the general election, I'm a Republican, I register as a Republican, you can't vote in the Republican primary that's following. Or if you don't say I'm a Democrat, you can't register in the Democratic vote. And I think you can see what the purpose of that limitation would be. We want to make sure that people who actually vote in the party are really the members of the party and aren't just claiming now to be a Republican so they can vote for or against a particular candidate, or claiming to be a Democrat so they can do that. We want to make sure there's a history of party affiliation at least 11 months back. And the court says, although that is a significant intrusion and doesn't allow just anybody to vote in any primary, that is allowed. And they distinguish Dunn versus Blumstein by saying that it doesn't violate your absolute right to vote, but merely imposes a time deadline. Okay. So 11 months, you can make somebody declare their party affiliation up to 11 months ahead of the primary. And you can disqualify them from voting in a primary if they didn't do that up to 11 months. But 23 months is too long. As the next paragraph points out, in Cusper versus Ponticus, the court invalidates an Illinois statute that essentially said that if you didn't vote in the primary election, in other words, you had to have voted in the most recent primary election of that party to be able to vote in this party. So it really meant that if you wanted to change parties, there could be a 23-month waiting period. And the court said that's just way too long. That locks voters into their pre-existing party affiliations from one primary to the next. That's too much. So 11 months is okay. Up to 11 months is okay. 23 months is too long. So you can see that this implied right to voting, fundamental rights area, has obligated the court to make some very interesting distinctions. In terms of when is the voting right to vote fundamental and not, making such distinctions as between a general obligation election, a general purpose election for a government unit, either bonds or who's going to be on the city council or who's going to be on the special the district, and special purpose districts, where there isn't a fundamental right to vote, and property or other kind of cumulative voting activities can be placed without, as long as they're rational. And the same thing with durational and party enrollment requirements. But nevertheless, a substantial stake in the ground has been established for the fundamental right to vote in general elections and in school board elections and various kinds of places. Now, there's a lot more to the story of the fundamental right to vote. There's, as I said, as you see on the bottom of 774, there's vote dilution. This idea about equality of vote, having votes counted equally, urban, rural, black, white, partisan gerrymandering, the Veith case, and all that sort of stuff I talk about in Con Law 1. But we're not going to talk about that. And in the interest of time, I'm also going to switch over some of the ballot access questions that begin on 791 about candidates getting access to the ballot, where a number of arcane distinctions have often been drawn. And instead, I'm going to switch to page 794 and talk about access to the judicial process after I give people a chance to ask questions. Yes? Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, but they can't say that in any
Yes, in fact, a good example of that is felons. Generally, the court has upheld, with some ballot pamphlet distinctions, generally the court has upheld the right to deny felons the right to vote or, certainly set qualifications. So you're right. It's more properly said not that there's a fundamental right to vote all the time, but there's a fundamental right to vote once the state has granted, people in this generally, their citizens the right to vote on this issue. To be free from unconstitutional distinctions. And most of the time, those distinctions have to pass strict scrutiny, except where it's like a special purpose district or something like that, where that doesn't implicate the fundamental right to vote on an equal basis. Rational distinctions can be drawn. Yes? Yes?
Is voting in the primary still considered a fundamental right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I'm not, I at best, I'm reporting these distinctions and teaching them, not defending them. I agree with you. 11 months seems like a long time. I would draw for freezing someone's party affiliation or letting them switch their party affiliation.
Maybe they were lowering the standard if it's a primary versus.
It's, I don't think it's really a primary versus general kind of thing. It is true to a certain extent. Because as I said, especially in recent years, the court has given political parties and their primaries and their selection of delegates and all that more deference, more off limits to government regulation. So I think that's fair to say. There is a primary, not because the primary is different, but because political parties have more rights, whereas by the time you're at the general election, the parties have done their will, they've chosen their candidates, and now it's more of a citizen concern. Good. Actually, it's a nice way to put it. So John, let's preserve this last little interchange. It's really good. In fact, let's put it on YouTube. Okay? Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry? All right. So the basic point is true that, in general, once the right to vote is granted, it has to be of equal protection, requires it to be afforded on an equal basis, and that doesn't just deal with race or gender discrimination or things that we might naturally fit under fundamental equal protection analysis, but distinctions like property owners versus non-property owners, people that have kids versus don't, poor people who can't afford poll taxes. The court has found a broad but not unlimited right to subject vote restrictions to strict scrutiny. It runs out at various points, and the court has tolerated 11 months without saying that's narrowly drawn to accomplish. They're not really hauling out the mechanism of strict scrutiny and finding that it's met. They're upholding it under a more relaxed standard. Okay, then we get into the right of access to the judicial process, which is on page 794. Here again, there's cases on both sides. I would say, unlike the voting area, where the presumption or kind of the classic presumption is that there is a fundamental right, here it's the exception. Granting a fundamental right to access to the judicial process is the exception, not the rule. And so a chart that looked at when government has to protect this fundamental right and when it doesn't, when the right isn't fundamental. Oh, that's barely even legible. I better rewrite that. We're going to have more things on the not part of the fundamental right of access to the courts than, yes, part of it. So, fundamental right, part of the fundamental right of access, yes versus no. Again, notice why this ends up in equal protection is because partly a historical accident. We'll see that some of the kinds of judicial proceedings that one has special rights to or special access to are ones that relate to some of the fundamental rights under substantive due process, like right to establish paternity, right to divorce, right to have child custody, etc. So in some ways, the court could have put those under substantive due process. They didn't, as I've already talked about, for largely historical or accidental reasons. In other cases, and you could think that there might be a right of a criminal defendant under the Sixth Amendment, right to a fair trial, or there might be. But because the court has not wanted to ask a bunch of questions, which is how, what kind of procedures do you need to have a fair trial versus not, or fit that into that, it's been carved out as a special access to the judicial process. So one has a selectively fundamental right to access to certain judicial processes and often does not have a right. So let's quickly go through and try to identify where they are. So the top of 795, Griffin versus Illinois. Court holds in Griffin, 1956 case, that the state has to furnish an indigent criminal defendant with a free trial transcript if such a transcript is necessary for adequate and effective appellate review. Okay, so the right to access to the judicial process, if you're indigent and you need a transcript, a trial transcript, to have your lawyer figure out a basis for appeal, you have a right to have that provided freely and not pay for it if you're indigent. In Douglas versus California, the next case, the court says that an indigent criminal defendant has a right to counsel on appeal. Whether or not the counsel is helpful to the defendant in the court, we of course think counsel are always helpful to appeals because we think you're always better off with a lawyer than without one. But what the California rule said is that state appellate courts, when requested by indigents, will independently look at the record and appoint counsel on appeal only if that independent court analysis says that counsel would be helpful. Okay, so the court says that 6-3, that violates this fundamental right of access to criminal appeals. These are appeals. Obviously, we're giving these rights. And so appointed counsel. Of course, as you know, at the trial level, you have a right to appointed counsel under which amendment is that, Crim Pro? Right to counsel? Sixth Amendment still? Ask a Crim Pro professor, but, you know, we have in one of the major criminal procedure landmark cases established a right to of indigence to counsel at trial. Here we're talking about appointed counsel at appeal, regardless of the necessity. That is, it's not required. You can't hinge the right of appointed counsel on appeal to an independent evaluation by a judge about whether counsel is really necessary or not. Now, again, echoing the question that was asked earlier, is you don't have an inherent right to an appeal, right? You can't. But if the state generally affords a right to appeal, you know, a mandatory appeal, one bite at the apple of appeal at least, and the state affords that, then one's indigency cannot prevent one from getting a lawyer. The state has a responsibility to appoint counsel. And that's Douglas' case. On the other hand, notice some of the distinctions or some of the areas where this right runs out. The first case is the Ross case. Note 4 on page 797, Ross versus Moffitt. Ross holds that the Constitution doesn't require states to provide counsel to defendants who are petitioning for discretionary state appellate review or review to the Supreme Court of the United States. So although you have appointed counsel if you have appeal as of right, your first right to appeal. So everybody can appeal to an intermediate appeal court. If that's what the state law says, then you have a right to counsel. But no right to counsel for discretionary appeals, either to state appellate courts or the U.S. Supreme Court. Which is frankly why, in, as we learn in my current issues class, such a high percentage of the cert petitions written to the court, Supreme Court, are not written by lawyers, but are written by jail, by defendants, state and federal defendants who are in their law library trying to write a petition for certiorari and try to interest the court in their case without a lawyer, often. Okay, so distinction is between when you've got a right to appeal, your indigency can't prevent you from getting access to a lawyer, i.e. the state has a responsibility to appoint one. On the other hand, that's not for discretionary review. This is also limited by the Fuller case, note 5 on page 798. Fuller versus Oregon has this situation where, upheld a law that said, okay, we'll give you a right, we'll give you counsel. We'll give indigents the right to counsel, but we can recoup the money if the person becomes non-indigent. So if the person's indigency is lifted, they start getting job making money, or they fall heir to an inheritance from their rich uncle or something like that, the state can recoup the costs. And the court upheld that in Fuller, even though there was an obvious argument made by the dissenters that the risk of potential recoupment will prevent or a defendant from wanting appointed counsel. They'll refuse appointed counsel because they'll be afraid that someday, if they get back on their feet a little bit, the state will try to recoup the money. And the court said, no, recoupment statutes are okay. Even if it creates an incentive to decline appellate counsel, provided that, and this is where we go back on the other side of the fence here, showing you again the same kind of arcane distinctions that are drawn here. In the last full paragraph on 798, the James case and the Rinaldi case, James said, yeah, you can have a recruitment statute, but not if you deprive defendants you're trying to recoup from the usual exemptions and restrictions that you can ordinarily get if you're trying to get out of a civil judgment. So, recoupment statutes are not constitutional under the fundamental right of access to the courts if they impose special restrictions on criminal defendants that other people trying to avoid judgments can't assert. So special restrictions on defenses or exemptions or whatever you want to call it. And then the Rinaldi case says that when you're making a distinction between unsuccessful appellants confined to prison versus those who had suspended sentences or on probation or whatever. So when we're making a distinction between defendants in prison versus defendants on probation in terms of the ability to recoup. And this is a great little example, because if we were using the usual equal protection analysis and saying, what's the basis for this classification? Is it one we're suspicious about? We don't give suspect classification or heightened scrutiny to classifications that distinguish between whether one's in prison or on probation. Prison versus probation is not a typical distinction that generates heightened scrutiny, but it does here because it implicates the fundamental right of access to the criminal courts. Why? Because of this concern that if there's a recoupment statute and it's an unfair recoupment statute, it's going to interfere with the willingness and the right of people to use appointed counsel, and therefore it'll prevent them from meaningful and fair access to the criminal appeal process. Again, all this is just, equal protection is a strange indirect route for doing this. It would seem to be more direct to talk about as a fair trial right or a due process right. Sorry, I don't make it up. I just report it. And then we get into the civil. There's a right of access for certain civil cases. Here again, there is a pattern. So there's a fundamental right of access to the courts to civil proceedings. The fundamental right of access to civil proceedings does give some rights. And partly in the interest of time and partly because they don't merit a lot of significant discussion, we'll just march through these. The body case. Body versus Connecticut, $7.99. Said it was unconstitutional to require indigents or poor people in state divorce cases to pay court fees and costs of about $60. So the fundamental right to access to civil process says that the state has to waive court fees for divorce for poor people. Not, you know, Donald Trump's not going to get it waived, but if you're poor, you're indigent, although Donald does declare bankruptcy periodically, so I shouldn't say that. But that's the body case. That's the initial, you know, each of these cases has like a first case that set a precedent, and then the rest of the cases are tweaking that precedent. Body versus Connecticut was the interesting precedent that says American society bottoms its systematic definition of individual rights and duties on the common law model. It's up to courts to make sure that dispute settlement and access are preserved. There's some other distinctions here. For example, the Sosna case says, but you can delay access for up to a year. But let's draw a contrast with the Crass case on page 4. I'm sorry, note 4, page 801. In United States versus Crass, you got $50 costs and fees for a bankruptcy proceeding. And the Supreme Court says, no, not bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is not, the fundamental right of access to civil proceedings does not extend to bankruptcy proceedings. And therefore, there's no obligation to waive the filing fees and costs of $50 for bankruptcy, and it does not turn on $60 versus $50. Okay? And same thing with Ortwein versus Schwab, note 5, page 802. No requirement to waive an appellate court filing fee as somebody who's going to appeal an administrative decision relating to welfare benefits. So an administrative appeal, an appeal of an administrative agency decision, no requirement to waive that. But then we get, and I'm going to cover these in significant rapid succession, Little versus Streeter, very bottom of 802, invalidates a statute that requires the party moving for blood grouping tests in a paternity action to pay for the tests, as applied to an indigent party. So an indigent, a poor person, has the right to free blood typing tests for paternity, in a paternity action. And in the MLB case on the top of 803, there is the right to... I can't even read my notes here. So let me be clear. What we had is a state statute that conditions appeals from trial court decrees terminating parental rights on the affected party's payment of fees for preparation of the record. So free record prep to appeal a parental rights termination. So if somebody has their parental rights terminated in an initial proceeding, they get the right to appeal that, even if, and notwithstanding a rule that usually requires people to pay for the record. As I say, I think these are understandable. Even though this did not proceed along substantive due process grounds, these are understandable on grounds of the kind of rights that normally substantive due process protects. If you look at what's common about civil proceedings involving divorce, paternity or parental rights, we're talking about the right to marry or divorce, or the right to have one's relationship with one's children not interrupted illegitimately. And in all those cases, the court has extended the fundamental right of access to civil proceedings as against indigents and fee waivers and that kind of thing. On the other hand, where the it doesn't implicate an interest that's part of a fundamental due process right, the court has not required waiver of fees for indigents. even though, obviously, welfare benefits are very important to a poor person, and even though bankruptcy is very important to a poor person. Poverty and indigency may trigger bankruptcy. But economic interests are not protected as fundamental under substantive due process, and therefore, that appears to explain the line in terms of the line of cases that it appears to explain why they differ. So in both these cases, criminal and civil, we're trying to figure out when is there a state, when is the state, when is indigency going to interfere with a core aspect, a right to appeal that you're given as a right, or recoupment that's stacked against you, versus, on the other hand, the sort of more discretionary, if you will, frilly kind of extra benefits we give people in the criminal justice process, including the fact that if you got appellate counsel as an indigent, recoupment would be allowed if you're no longer indigent. Any questions about that? Clarifications? I know, you need to run for an espresso, right? You'll get a chance, because these cases are so boring. Yeah. They're very important rights, of course, and these distinctions are just boring if taught this way. Sorry, though, because the alternative is to spend 2 or 3 days reading through all the cases and all that, and it's just we have to draw the line somewhere. Then we get into the third fundamental right that is lodged for whatever reason under equal protection, and that's the right to travel. Again, it's an implied right. You will not find a right to vote on an equal basis other than race and all that expressly stated in the Constitution. There's no right to access to certain aspects of the criminal and civil trial, that at least the express rights that deal with due process and fair trials and civil and criminal trials have not been elaborated to afford this right. So we find an implied right to access to the courts. Similarly, the court has found that there's an implied right to travel interstate. Even though, of course, there are parts that talk about interstate commerce, full faith and credit, etc., but a right to travel. And I tell you, when I first studied this, when I first saw in the syllabus of my con law class that we're going to study the right to travel, I got excited. I thought, wow, I like travel. You know, I could sort of see myself having a constitutional right to go to Italy and drink wine and eat pasta and all. No, sorry, that's not what it turned out to be. The right to travel turned out to be the right to move interstate and relocate and not have your new status as a resident, as or your status as a new resident or a non-resident, be used against you in certain situations. It's hilarious that I brought multi-state questions. I mean, I'm barely going to get through a general romp through this right to travel stuff. But let me hit some highlights. Again, the classic first case is Shapiro versus Thompson on page 803. Shapiro was a one-year residency requirement before anyone could get welfare. And, you know, the state had some significant justifications for it. They said, first of all, to prevent fraud, we need to have a certain time limit. People shouldn't just be able to move here and get welfare the day after they move here. And if they could do that, we're worried that if our welfare benefits are more generous, we're going to actually become a welfare mill. People are going to move here in order to get welfare. And so both to take away that incentive and to allow us to prevent fraud and, you know, protect the public fisc and all that, we're going to require a one-year residency requirement before any welfare is available. And the court struck that down and said, sorry, there's a fundamental, that might be rational to do that. It might be rational to make that distinction, one-year residency before any welfare. But because the right to travel interstate is fundamental, and establish residency in a new location, because that's a fundamental right, and this law is not narrowly drawn to accomplish these purposes, it fails. And what this language over here says is the purpose is to fence out indigents or reward long-standing residents or administrative rational planning. These would all be rational bases, right? It would be rational for a state to not want to become the welfare state for neighboring states because of their generosity, not have their generosity used against them. Or you might want to reward long-standing residents. Or you might want to allow rational administrative planning. How can we do that if people can just waltz in, become a resident one day, and the next day they're they're entitled to welfare? Those are all rational bases. The point is not good enough because we're applying something more than that. The court then, in the Sens case, S-A-E-N-Z, on page 807, invalidates a one-year limit that doesn't say no welfare. What the Shapiro law said is, you don't get any welfare from our state for a year. After a year, after you've been a resident for a year, you can qualify, but not for the first year. And of course, if, you know, by definition, people that need welfare are people that are destitute and may not be able to live comfortably or with any degree of security for that year while they're waiting for it. So Sens says, okay, we got something more moderate for you. It just says that, this is California law that says, new residents get welfare from us, but they only get the amount they got in their past state, the state they moved from. Often California laws, welfare benefits are more generous. You get more welfare in California than elsewhere. So if you're a resident in the state of a year or more, you get the California amount. If you're new to the state, you get what you would have gotten back in your old state. So it was not a no welfare for the first year. It was a less welfare for the first year if your previous state paid less. And again, you can see the obvious rationale there. California's rationale was, look, that will reduce the incentive for people to move to get more money from California. If they know that in the first year, they're not going to get that. They're going to only come if they are making more of a lifestyle decision or more of a long-standing change. They're not just going to come across the border in search of more money. That's rational, but the court said, sorry, not good enough. Under the rule of Shapiro, this is unconstitutional. The rule, again, if there's a rule of thumb here, it's generally speaking durational residency requirements. That is a requirement that one be a resident for a certain amount of time before one gets benefits, or differential costs for out-of-state tuition versus in-state and all that, generally speaking, are not allowed. And you can go, you can march through these different cases and see that. Zobel versus Williams, page 809, note 1. Alaska statute. Alaska's going rogue here. They're distributing income from their natural resources to their citizens, and the amount of money you get as your benefit varies depending on how long you've been a resident. Makes sense, right? If you've been here in Alaska, building up Alaska and making the state work, and you know, insert your own Sarah Palin joke. I'm not going to put it in there. You get benefited for state past contributions, but the court says sorry, not allowed. That's discrimination against new residents. Page 810, Hooper versus Bernalillo County Assessor. New Mexico statute grants special tax exemptions to Vietnam veterans who were New Mexico residents before a certain day. Sorry. That's favoring long-standing residents over new residents. Violation of the fundamental right to travel. Court admits that all the past cases were talking about waiting periods, whereas this is, again, just differential benefits. And there's also a case that says that, I've lost my place, as you can tell from my hemming and hawing here. A requirement that you have to be a one-year resident before you can get non-emergency medical care in Arizona. Not allowed. as you can see, these are largely internal notes, probably not worth putting up here. But on the other hand, a one-year residency requirement to get a divorce is allowed. It's one of those, it sort of sticks out as an exception. And the rationale there is that a state has more of a right to keep itself from becoming a divorce mill, having people just come across the border and establish bogus residency to get divorces. That's a higher interest in the state preserving its divorce proceedings for its own residents. Although people have argued that doesn't make sense. Restrictions on out-of-state admittance to the bar have also been invalidated, although under the Privileges and Immunities Clause, interestingly. And reduced tuition for state universities, also not allowed in certain cases. Really all the court seems to have allowed are restrictions that are designed to make sure that someone really is a resident. That's the last subject I'll talk about in 30 seconds, which is page 813, note 4, bona fide residency requirements. So the court has considered and upheld a number of situations which are designed to make sure that people really are residents, that they're not faking residency to try to get a benefit. That's different. But once somebody is a bona fide resident, even if they're a new resident, under a year, you can't deny them welfare at all. You can't deny their the same amount of welfare you give to residents. You can't discriminate against the length of time someone's been a resident and benefits that you give, veterans or natural resources. And you can't discriminate in non-emergency medical services. That's the Maricopa County, the other Maricopa County case on the top of 812. But what you can do is keep your divorce facilities, your divorce proceedings off limits for a year, and you can engage in bona fide residence requirements to make sure people really are residents. And as long as those are reasonable, those will be upheld. We've reached the end of our time. It would be no longer reasonable to keep you, but I'm happy to stay behind a little bit and answer questions from anyone that has them, and certainly we'll include this in the series of discussions that we can have in office hours or elsewhere. But thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you, those of you that have been watching on the video, those of you that are listening in the podcast. Everybody else, I don't thank you. Bye. Yeah, figure that out, right? Okay.